You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Exodus chapter 20, we have finally reached the point at which the Israelites have come to Mount Sinai and they're hearing God speak. It gets to the point in verse 18 or 19 where they say, we can no longer hear him. It's too powerful. We want an intercessor. We want Moses. You go up and talk to him. Here we just see God full blast speaking. And what is he speaking about? Well, if you're with us last week, he's speaking about this covenant or this contract that he had with the people. What in, you know, common parlance has been called the Ten Commandments. We pick up in verse 1 of chapter 20. God spoke all these words. So how does this whole subject of morality and ethics begin? God. That's where it begins. From a Christian worldview, a Christian view of reality, we begin with God himself. Now, at this point, some people will say, you know, do we really need God to have morality? And it may surprise you to hear a Bible teacher say, no. No, we do not. We can still do a number of things, morally speaking, if we don't have God. If God doesn't exist, we could still have morality. We could still be kind and loving to other people. Why do I need God to be kind and loving to other people? God doesn't, you know, before people even knew God, they were kind and loving to others. You don't need God for that. If God doesn't exist, we can still make social contracts with each other. You know, if you have this part of the property, we're going to have this dividing line and we're going to negotiate that and we can have a third party kind of adjudicate the contract. We can sign the contract. We can even get a notary. We don't need God to be there. If God doesn't exist, we can still pass legislation that promotes fairness for people, regardless of who they are. Equality for all human persons. If God doesn't exist, we can still enforce rules that lead to pleasure and not suffering and pain. We don't need God for that. God doesn't need to exist to have police arrest violent people. This is a whole picture that people have that they say, we don't need God for any of these things. Agreed. That's right. We don't need God for morality. We need God to exist for objective morality, not subjective morality. Objective is in the object out there. Subjective is in the subject in here. So if I look at this cup of water and I say, I like drinking from that cup, is that subjective or objective? Good. One guy got it. That's great. Wonderful. Subjective. I gave it away. I, the subject, like drinking from this cup of water. Delicious. But if I said that cup is gray, true or false, I'm making an objective claim about the cup, that the object is either gray or it isn't. And in order to have objective morality, we need to have the existence of God. So yes, we could be kind and loving to others if God doesn't exist. We could also be sadistic to others. If God doesn't exist, we could make social contracts or we could break social contracts. After all, we made a contract about there's a line in the sand and the boundaries of our property are on this line. But we got it notarized. But we signed. But we both agreed. Yeah. Now I disagree. Well, it's binding on you. What is the piece of paper? What your grandma says? I need to keep this contract. I don't need to keep that. It's subjective. Pass legislation that promotes racism and sexism. You see what I'm saying? Yes, we could still do certain things. The question is, should we? Ought we do that? That particular legislation, is that right or wrong to have racist or sexist legislation? Enforcing rules that lead to pleasure for the rich. What's to stop us? Will you say that's wrong? Ah, there we go. We're passing legislation or making rules, appealing to some sort of standard above ourselves. What is that standard? Or what is that foundation upon which we're building? have police arrest violent criminals or have police arrest anyone we want. One person, atheistic thinker, said, when we say that we need God to have morality, what we really are saying is we need more police. My rebuttal? Yes, police to enforce which laws? The secret police to arrest Jews? Or the police that are supposed to arrest violent criminals? The police are going to do what we tell them to enforce. The question is, how do we decide and adjudicate between which laws are good and which are evil, which are right and which are wrong? That is the moral question. So nobody's disputing that you can have subjective morality any more than someone's disputing your favorite flavor of ice cream. Nobody cares. What we're saying is the greater question, is there an objective standard? And if we're talking about objective morality, then yes, we do need the existence of God. If nature is all, then all is natural. If nature is all, then all is natural. What does that mean? Well, if there's nothing above nature, if all that there is just nature, matter and energy, the laws of physics, if that's it, if that's all that there is, then everything that happens in nature is according to physical law. That means we're determined by physical law, like gravity or quantum mechanics or whatever, Newtonian physics, Einsteinian physics, whatever you prefer. It's all within the machine. And we're all just meat machines, you know, acting according to our programming, dancing to our DNA. We're electrochemical machines. That's all we are. So wind could come through. That's one natural force, and it could blow down an orphanage. That's not right or wrong. It's just wind. Well, an asteroid could come through and, you know, blow up a school. Well, that's just the way it is in nature. It's acting according to physical law. Well, if everything is just natural in nature, which is indisputable, by the way, it's true by definition, that means everything that happens in nature is natural, including moral atrocities. So Mao's revolution, killing somewhere between 20 to 46 million people. Hitler's Holocaust, 6 million people. The rape of Nanking. Too gruesome to describe in a public setting. Go home and look it up tonight for yourself. The way that the Japanese killed, tortured, violated, did every despicable thing you could imagine to the Chinese in the 1930s. The rape of Nanking. When we look at that, it was all within the domain of nature. That's just what happens in nature. But if we have a transcendent source, like God, that means there's something supernatural, something outside of nature to whom we're accountable, and a personal being, someone who is himself good, loving, kind, someone who issues commands. You shall be loving, you shall be kind, and ultimately will keep us morally accountable. We need God to have objective morality because without God, human value is an illusion. If nature is all there is, what are humans? At the end of the day, we're the accidental pregnancy of energy acting on matter plus time plus chance. We're just a bunch of cells clumped together. I guess we're differently clumped. There's a different complexity. People say, well, we have more neurons than other animals. Yeah, 100 billion. What if we had 80 billion? What if we had 60? What if we had 20 billion? Would it really matter? Well, we have 37 trillion cells in the human body. So if I get rid of some of those cells, I just committed mass genocide. You're all watching it right now. These skin cells, I'm just flicking them to death right now. So cells, that's what makes us really matter. Well, I just killed a bunch of living things. What, the carbon inside of us, the sodium? Human value is an illusion. I hope you can see that. On a naturalistic worldview, human equality, demonstrably false. You ever heard people say, you know, all human beings are equal? Nonsense. Nonsense. Unless God exists. That is demonstrably false. You say, what do you mean? Okay, here's my car. 2006 Hot Rod Toyota Matrix. Now, what would happen if I totaled that car and it actually looked more like this? It would have the same parts, the same plastic, the same engine. I'm sure some hoses and, you know, drivetrain is all bent up in the one. They both have four tires, they have headlights, they've got a steering wheel, a clutch. What's wrong with those? Well, one is functional. One is, you know, you're actually, you can drive the one on the left, obviously. Nobody would have any worth for the one on the right except for maybe a scrapper. You take that for scrap. But what about this picture here? Here's the smartest child in Ghana, Jeremiah Addo. At the age of 2, he was naming 140 countries and their presidents. Now he's 5 or 6 years old. He's doing advanced chemistry. Okay, this kid is absolutely brilliant. This kid on the right is both physically and mentally disabled. Those two children do not function the same way. They don't. The one on the left is able to run, lift weights, you know, move around. The one on the right, severely limited. Clearly, demonstrably, indisputably, those two children are not equal. You say, yes, they are. They're both human. Yeah, the two cars are both cars. Right? Oh, yeah, but they're both from Ghana. Yeah, those are both from Toyota. Right? That's my point. See, without God existing, we don't have human beings, we have human doings. You're not intrinsically valuable, just value because God loves you and because you're a member of the human family and you're someone for whom Jesus died. Talk about value. Instead, you're only instrumentally valuable. You're valuable for what you can do. So from a Christian worldview, we could honestly say those two little boys are equally valuable. Why? Because they're made in the image of God. They're someone for whom Jesus died. They have incommensurable value, unbelievable value. But this fiction of people who say we don't need God to have human equality, that's all it is. It's just an assertion with zero foundation. What if I just walked around and said, well, yeah, God exists. How do you know that? Well, I just assert it to be true. You know, I'd be laughed out of here. Those two kids, they're equal. How do you know that? Well, they just are. They just are. That's what we call blind faith. So if you have a problem being able to say that humans have value, that moral atrocities are indeed evil, or that little kids are not equal, I think that's the time to pause and reflect on the poverty of your worldview. That would be something I would want to be very upset with, that I couldn't affirm objective morality in any meaningful way. Well, we start with God. God needs to exist. But then God also speaks these things to us. It's not just that we are floundering around trying to figure out what he thinks about these things. And this brings us to what is referred to as the Decalogue. Deca meaning 10, logos meaning word. Literally the 10 words. The 10 commandments is an antiquated translation. It's not in the Bible. Of course, these are imperatives. So in that sense, they're commandments. But the introduction here is that they're the 10 words of God. The Dabar. Dabar in Hebrew means word. Debarim, that im suffix means a plural, words. It's the 10 words of God that he's given to us. On 2 tablets. Tonight we studied the first tablet of the law, the first 4 commandments. These all relate to God. Commandments 5 through 10 relate to people. And contrary to what you've seen in every movie with Moses, they weren't big. You ever see Charlton Heston carrying around those stone commandments and he's moving them around? He's 80 years old, first of all. He's carrying those around, these big stone. That's impossible. Anyways, the real commandments, probably the size of your cell phone. Why would they carry around big rocks like that? Tiny, real tiny. We have other inscriptions like this from this time period. Very tiny, you can hold them in the palm of your hand, and 2 tablets based on creation. This is totally coherent with what we see in Genesis 1 and 2. You know, we're going to read, you shall not worship any other gods. Why not? Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God, singular, created the heavens and the earth. Why shouldn't we worship any other god? Because there are no other gods. That's why. You shall not commit adultery. Why not? Because God invented the first marriage. He gave the original man to the original woman. Why shouldn't we kill? You shall not murder. Because we were made in the image of God. Man and woman were both made in the... This is all predicated on our design as human beings. And so too, as we get into the civil laws, which get pretty tedious, pretty painful. If your ox gores somebody and you got to give him 30 shekels or and then, but if you knew he was going to gore him, then you got to get gored. And it just goes on like that for chapter after chapter after chapter. What are those civil laws there for? Well, they're there for the nation of Israel. And those are predicated on what we're going to read tonight. You shall not kill. That's the moral command. But how do we principalize that? Well, that would relate to, what if your animal's let loose and you knew about it and it kills somebody? That'd be a principalized version of the commandment, thou shalt not kill. And that's what we see throughout the civil laws. Of course, we're not in Israel, so we don't abide by the civil laws today. We appeal to natural law to create legislation. But at this time, they had a theocracy. They were run by God. Well, we read in verse 2, I am the Lord your God. I brought you up out of Egypt and out of the land of slavery. So we start with God. God speaks. And he begins with what? What they should do? God is saying, consider what I've done before, what you need to do. He's starting with a big done, not a big do. Well, let's get into it. Number one, commandment number one, do not worship other gods. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. Again, why should we not have any other gods? Because there are no other gods. Isaiah 45 says there are no other gods, either in the past or in the future. This whole idea that, you know, revolving God, or there have been an infinite number of gods and we're going to turn into gods, according to Isaiah 45, it's false. There is no other God beside me. When it says before me, you shall have no other gods before me, according to R. Allen Cole, this phrase was used of talking about a second wife while the first one is still alive. To have another God in competition to the true God. Now, of course, in the case of adultery, this would be quite literal. Here it's metaphorical. It's not that there are literally other gods. As we saw, God, Yahweh, is not a provincial deity for Israel. He's the God of the entire earth. Yet, this would include ancestor worship, worshiping the state, worshiping kings. Psalm 82 refers to the human rulers as Elohim. That's the word for God. Don't worship humans. Don't worship angels. Don't worship demons. Don't worship your ancestors. Ye shall have no other gods before me. Not like I should be at the top of the list in henotheism, the top God in all the gods. It's no, I'm the only God. There's no God that should come before me, period. End of discussion. Number two, do not create idols. Quite similar, verse 4. You shouldn't make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. Why shouldn't we create idols or images to worship? This is the context here. It isn't that you can't create art. Of course, we can create art. Otherwise, we're saying you really cannot create anything in the ocean. You can't draw a whale. You can't draw a cow, something like that, anything on the land. The context is you can't create something and worship it. That's the point. The reason is that if we were to make some sort of a man-made creation carved out of wood, of God, of what God is like, that would domesticate God. That would basically make God in our own image. The transcendent, ineffable. You know what that means? Indescribable. Ineffability is, I can't even describe, can't put into words what God is like. His infinitude. How do you even speak of it? That kind of power, that knowledge, being everywhere all at once, immutable, never change. How do you describe that? Well, we describe it by pulling out my pocket knife and carving a little idol, and that's what God is like. No, 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 no. Wrong. You shall not make any kind of an idol. God made us in his image. We're in the image of God, not the other way around. We don't make God in the image of us, which is what we see here today in our modern world. This is not just for the ancient Near East, nor for the time of the New Testament in the first century. We constantly, and I want you to think about this, are looking out at God and we're projecting our own views onto him. So if you're a Republican, God is a right winger. If you're a Democrat, God is liberal. If you're, you know, a war hawk, God's pro-war. If you're a pacifist, turn the other cheek. You know, you can always find everything to back up your own view. What is that? That's idolatry. That's what it is. Now, I'm not making a statement one way or the other about any of those things I mentioned. What I'm saying is that there is a propensity in the human heart to project an image of God that isn't really there. It's incumbent, in other words, on us to discover what the true God is actually like, not to make an image that looks exactly like us. So too, we become what we worship. We read in Psalm 115, verse 4, their idols are merely things shaped by human hands, and those who make idols, catch this, those who make idols are just like their idols, as are all who trust in them. Oh, Israel, trust in the Lord. You make an idol, you create this idol to worship, and then you start to look like that idol. Whatever you set your mind on, that's what you start to become. And when we get into idolatry, well, you say, okay, this is a little bit abstract. Again, I get the idea. If you carve something out and then that's your idol and you make it up, that's pretty silly. We have idols today. What makes you emotional? What about, you know, your portfolio, your money, your grades, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, anything in your life that gets you really emotional? One guy, he had this hot rod car, and I mean in the real sense, not in the 2006 Toyota Matrix sense. If you would even just sit up against that car, man, he would come out of his seat. What was that? That was his idol, his little cream puff there, and you can't touch it. That's my God right there. What do you daydream about? Being, you know, a really influential person, being such a wonderful person, being so special, being admired, being applauded, being famous, being successful. All these things reveal what's really in our heart, what we really value, where we spend our time, our talent, our treasure. These are all idols. And many of these things in and of themselves aren't even bad. That's not the point. The problem is we've taken these little wood carvings and we've elevated them into the transcendent. We're all of a sudden just owning a car. That's great. Good for you. But now we've turned that car into a god. And it's completely inordinate, out of order. And the idea here is, I have no idols before me. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, God says, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents. God is jealous? Man, 1 Corinthians 13 says that love is not jealous. So God is either not jealous or he's not loving, which is a Christian. Well, in this case, we've got a poor translation of the text. That term jealous, and I'm not just saying this because it rhymes, could also be rendered zealous, to have zeal, to have emotion. In other words, for somebody to be worshiping an idol, and many of these idols are quite sick and deranged, offering your children, sacrificing your children to these idols. Baal and Asherah were idols. Baal was the male deity. Asherah was the female deity. The priest would dress up like Baal, the bull god. And Asherah, they'd get a priestess to dress up like the female god Asherah. And then they would have sex in front of the idol temple because they were trying to get Baal and Asherah in the heavens to get sexually aroused so that they would bring fertility to the land. You say, that's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard. True. What would it mean about God if he looked at that? Women being sexually assaulted for religious purposes. Babies being put on the hands of Kronos, one of the deities that they would heat up to high temperatures and let those babies just sizzle. We have archaeological findings of the little bones of babies beneath these idols. What would it mean for God to look at that with just complete indifference? Just doesn't care whatsoever. No. He's zealous. He gets angry about that. Why? For his benefit? Because he's jealous and insecure. He's just so cosmically lonely and insecure. He needs a little termite like me to worship him. No, it's because he's so cosmically loving that when he sees me worshiping something that isn't him, the greatest conceivable good, he looks at that and he says, okay, I cannot stand that. He even says, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Idolatry is on par with hatred toward God. That's what he's saying. What's the stuff about punishing the kids, though? That sounds pretty severe. To the third and fourth generation? But wait a minute. Ezekiel 18, verse 20 says, the person who sins will die. Not their kid or their grandkid. The person who sins. The son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity. Each person is judged according to what they do. So either we're misreading Ezekiel 18 or we're misreading Exodus 20, verse 5. Which is it? Walter Kaiser, he's an Old Testament specialist. He says that scriptural language frequently attributes directly to God what he merely permits. You see the difference? Sometimes it looks like God is the direct cause of something in the Hebrew Bible. When other times we read in a parallel passage that actually God was he used a secondary cause. We see many examples where God is the direct cause, and yet we read another passage and it says, no, he's the ultimate cause, but he uses a material cause, like, you know, pressure systems in the atmosphere. What we're seeing here is a reference to God's passive wrath. God's active wrath is where he comes in and he judges. He strikes somebody dead. His passive wrath, this is crazy. God's passive wrath is not when he puts his hands on you to judge you. It's when he takes his hands off and just lets you go. You say, how is that wrath? He lets you go? God is so good that for him to say, do it your way, is a form of judgment. And so what we're seeing here is that when people choose to sin against God, to get into idolatry, this has an effect, a cause and effect relationship, down to your kids and their kids and maybe even their kids. Let me give you an example. Your great-grandfather who was an alcoholic, how did it work out for your grandfather? How did it work out for your dad? How did it work out for you? Cause and effect relationship. When we say, we just want to break away from these rules and restrictions of God. They're so controlling, so restrictive. Basically what we're saying is, we want to go out on our own. And God says, you're allowed to do that. However, the result is there's going to be punishment. And the punishment is doing it your way. Oh, that is a horror that is beyond description. For God, it was so good just to say, go ahead. Notice this too. Even in the midst of describing judgment, punishing to the third and fourth generation, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. What do you think we're supposed to pick up there? God says, I will judge. I am a God of justice. And yet my grace outweighs my justice. These could have just balanced each other out. Instead, what we have is not some kind of a dualism in God's character. But God actually says, I found a way for my love of people who are sinful, moral violators, to be forgiven. And it's in his very nature that he's a God of love. Just think about that. I don't know if we're supposed to do the math. You know, how many more times is 1,000 more than 3 or 4? But whatever it is, hyperbole or whatever, this is saying God is incredibly loving. Commandment number 3, do not misuse God's name. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Or perhaps you've heard taking the Lord's name in vain. Misusing God's name, what does it mean? Number 1, it could mean swearing an oath, calling on God as my witness. I swear to God. And especially in a religious culture such as this, this would have a lot of oomph behind it. I swear on God, and you're misusing God's name as a way to effectively lie better. Now, there's times in the Old Testament where people swear on God's name. But what that means is, I really mean it. When we get to the New Testament, we see Jesus say, let your yes be yes and your no be no. You don't need oaths. James 5, same thing. Maybe it's 4. Yes be yes, no be no. We don't need to invoke God's name or anything like that. Having the kind of a character that people just trust what you say, you don't need to bring in God into this whole picture. This could also be misusing in the sense of the culture at the time, which was just inundated with sympathetic magic, the occult. And using someone's name wasn't just like we use it today. We give people nicknames. I've never gone up to somebody, you know, named Bill and said, hey, what's that name mean? B-I-L-L. I don't know. I don't know what it means. In this culture, every name had a meaning. And to know someone's name was to have power over them. This was sympathetic magic in the occult. So you could actually use someone's name as power. We see this even today, causing hexes on people according to their name. And well, that's a study for another time. Anyways, this would be using Yahweh's name as a means through which we could curse other people, as a way, a vehicle for power. That'd be bad. Don't misuse God's name. Number four, fourth commandment, and finally, do not work on the Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. On the Sabbath you shall not do any work, neither you, your son, your daughter, your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and he made it holy. What are we seeing here? Take a break. In this culture it was work, work, work. And we're moving over from the system of the Egyptians, a 10-day work week. That's what they had. A decimal system of 10 days in a week. God saying, no, just 7. And on Saturday, day off. Rest. Now, today, you don't see us taking a day off on Saturday. You say, oh, you're a hypocrite. You know, follow the 10 commandments. No, Jesus came in and said, actually, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. The Sabbath is not for God. God made the Sabbath for man. This is a gift. Just not to work, but to rest. And we see you shouldn't be a judge of days and Sabbaths, Colossians 2:16. However, this is a very good biblical principle. We should keep. We should keep. Running. I was talking to somebody recently about the schedule I used to pull back in the day. I said I used to work 2 jobs and go to school full time and do this, do that, and the other thing. And I just was, and he was like, so how did you do that? And I said, I didn't. It was terrible. It was not a healthy lifestyle. Definitely out of God's will. So I don't know what you need to do to factor in some time into your schedule where you can just get some rest, relax. I don't mean this, you know, up and down on your phone, rick-a-dick-a-doo, you know, catching up on that. I mean some soul rest, taking time just to sit with God, do things that you like, get some exercise, something that's healthy, okay? Working this into your schedule, particularly when there's times where you're running through a couple weeks, 3 weeks in a row, you got a busy 3 weeks, and you got a plan at the end of that, I'm going to take some time off. We got to work this in. Yeah. Well, as we wrap this up, what are we learning about God from these first 4 commandments? Number 1, he needs to exist if we're going to have any kind of moral imperatives whatsoever. Any moral system needs 3 things: moral values, good and evil, moral duties, right and wrong, and moral accountability. And God offers all of this. The Christian worldview is dynamite on this for a moral system. Somebody might say, well, again, I don't need God to have morality. Okay, I get it. I get what you're saying. It's not like you read the commandment, you shall not kill, and you said, oh, I thought I should kill. I thought killing was great, you know. You shall not steal. I thought stealing was a great idea. You don't need the 10 commandments to know right from wrong. We're saying there needs to be a God in order for these things to have any kind of effect. Like a guy saying something like this, you know, I didn't have a biological father. Excuse me? I don't have a biological father. You mean you don't know your biological father? No, I didn't have a biological... Dude, if you didn't have a biological father, you wouldn't exist. Now, you don't know your biological father. I get that. You don't, but you know at least that he exists. And here we have a whole world of moral accountability and moral laws and values. We're looking at that, and yet we're saying, no, 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 nothing created all that. There's no God that has a moral system in front of us. No, I don't buy it. Number 2, God's moral design for us is good. We read in Deuteronomy 10, obey the Lord's command for your own good. Remember we said this was based on God's design. God created us. Therefore, number three, we don't break God's laws. Nobody ever broke a law of God. They break us. We break ourselves over them. You don't break the law of gravity. It breaks you. And so when you go outside the moral realm of reality, it breaks you. So for us, we're saying, you know, God's got an issue in my life. He's got his finger on it. And I'm just going to flout that like it's not that big of a deal. I want you to think about that. I want you to have that on your conscience and think about that. Because what you're saying is, I can get through this world. God's wrong. I'm right. And it doesn't work that way. There's something about reality that we bump into it. Finally, we learn where to begin with God here in this first tablet of the law. God wants you to begin by, number one, focusing on him. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt and out of slavery. He wants you to focus on what he's done, that he's a rescuing sort of God. And then three, repeat steps one and two. Take a day of the week, a Sabbath, whatever time your time is, to sit there and to think about who God is, what he's done for me. And then all of a sudden, what you start to see in your Bible, it lights up for you. There's some people that pick up their Bible and all they see is what I need to do, what I haven't been doing, what she hasn't been doing, comparison, performance. It's real ugly. It's not true spirituality. True spirituality begins right here. Focusing on God, what he's done, and particularly through the person of Christ. See, they didn't have this yet. But when Jesus came on the scene, Matthew 5, he says that he did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. Nobody ever kept the Ten Commandments except for one man, Jesus. So as we study through this, you might find yourself sinking lower and lower into your seat. That's the point. It's God saying, this is what I'm like. This is what you're like. And we need a mediator. Remember we talked about that? There is one mediator, the man Christ Jesus. And that's what we're supposed to take away from this whole study of the Ten Commandments. More on that next week.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.